The Arts and Science Lecture Series was established in 1968 as a means of honoring outstanding scholars within the college. Being chosen by one's peers to be the Arts and Science Lecturer is one of the highest honors that the College of Arts and Science can bestow on one of its faculty. It is a peer-determined award that recognizes the significant national and international reputation of an extraordinary scholar and teacher in the college. And tonight we have Professor of Anthropology James Stanlaw will be delivering the 82nd Arts and Science Lecture. And now I would like to have Dr. Fred Smith come forward and introduce Professor Stanlaw.
Thanks, Jim.
I've got it right here. First of all, I want to echo Jim's welcome to all of you for coming out tonight to honor Jim Stanlaw, and on behalf of my colleagues in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology, we extend to you our thanks as well. Of all of the fundamental human capabilities, none is more fascinating to us than language. Innumerable books, in fact, have been written on what language is and what it means. And it is still difficult to find a definition of language that doesn't raise the ire of some scholars. Most of us, of course, simply think of language as our means of communication. And as academics, we revel in its nuances and power to persuade and influence people on a variety of levels. If we ponder it a bit more, we certainly realize that language is one of the defining characteristics of what it means to be human. Because for all of the abilities demonstrated by apes, cetaceans, and elephants, for example, none really approaches the complexity of human language. But for a linguist, and especially a linguistic anthropologist, language is much, much more. It is, in fact, a window into understanding culture in general and individual cultures in particular, and it is a portal into the cognitive workings of the human mind. Many academics struggle with learning languages other than their native one, and many must probe the detailed nuances of these languages to get at the issues which drive their academic interests. But few have to achieve the level of language intimacy that linguistic anthropologists must. And few languages are more difficult to accomplish such a level of intimacy in as Japanese. At Illinois State, we are fortunate to have some very, very accomplished faculty members who are nationally and internationally known for their studies on Japan. And one of those is certainly our lecturer this evening. Professor James M. Stanlaw was trained initially at Northern Illinois University, where he was influenced by two fine linguistic anthropologists, my colleagues and friends Cecil Brown and the late Stanley Witkowski. He received his Ph.D. in linguistic anthropology from the University of Illinois in 1987 under another very fine linguistic anthropologist, Janet Keller. After some time of teaching stints at St. John's University and Columbia, Professor Stanlaw began his long and distinguished career here at ISU. The author of some 40 articles and scholarly books, he is co-editor of the refereed scholarly print journal Pan Japan, the International Journal of Japanese Diaspora, as well as a contributing editor to the Anthropology News and an officer in the Linguistic Anthropology section of the American Anthropological Association. He has received a number of scholarships and awards, including Fulbright and National Defense Foreign Language Fellowships, and research support from the Spencer Foundation and the National Science Foundation. His book, Japanese English, Language and Culture Contact, was nominated at the 2005 American Anthropological Association meetings for the Francis Hsu Prize as the best new book on East Asian anthropology. Professor Stanlaw is also an accomplished teacher and mentor, and has been nominated for teaching awards several times, including the very prestigious National Mayfield Award for Excellence in Undergraduate Teaching of Anthropology, given by the American Anthropological Association. He was chosen as one of Illinois State University's College of Arts and Sciences Teachers of the Year in 1994. As a linguistic anthropologist. Professor Stanlaw works broadly in four areas of specialization: Japanese sociolinguistics and ethnology, particularly language contact and women's language; cognition, especially color theory and nomenclature; immigration studies, the Japanese diaspora; and Asian and American popular culture, particularly music, in which he is a very robust participant. He has attained a national and international reputation for scholarly excellence as a linguistic anthropologist, and we are most fortunate to have him here at Illinois State. So with that, I am pleased and truly honored to introduce this semester's College of Arts and Sciences Distinguished Lecturer and my colleague in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology here at Illinois State, Professor James M. Stanlaw.
Go to it, Jim.
Good job. Starting off well? Well, I guess I don't need those anyway. Okay. Any more?
Yes.
Get them out of the way now.
I wasn't ready.
You're ready? Okay. Thank you. Okay. First of all, thank you, Dean Payne, Fred Smith, for that wonderful introduction. I really appreciate it very much. I kind of feel like, I guess, Brad Pitt at the Academy Awards. That's probably the closest I'll ever get to being like Brad Pitt. But it's nice to have the recognition from friends and colleagues. It's very humbling. I really do feel like, Wayne and Garth in Saturday Night Live, I'm not worthy, And it's really true. I really appreciate the honor bestowed on me, and it's really nice for everybody to do this. And I want to thank everybody, my friends, family, for coming. Tonight I have not only my mother and my wife, but my sister, my dissertation advisor, my chair, my dean, and the former guy I used to supervise being a TA for, okay, all in the audience. And so there are many people that criticize me today. So I guess I'm going to get it from all ends. So thank you all for coming. So there is no pressure at all. People I would be talking to on the street says, well, I'm going to, come and see what you have to say at my talk, and I said, well, that's really nice, but, others are saying they came to hear, not to hear what I'm going to be talking about, but to come to hear the joke. And there are not many linguistics jokes out there, and I tried one this afternoon on my colleagues, and it bombed. Did not work at all, and so I was not prevented from saying it, but I guess I was advised that probably be my best interest not to. So I guess it's going to be like a no-joke zone tonight, so if anybody came for a joke, there won't be any, though there may be one in the middle that I'll sneak in by accident. So I guess it'll be kind of like Wittgenstein. I guess Wittgenstein said that, he came home one day expecting a surprise, but there was no surprise. So, of course, he was surprised, okay? So I guess it might be kind of this way with the joke, that one might sneak in there later on. But we'll see, probably against maybe my better judgment. So maybe the title might be kind of interesting. It's certainly a little bit different than... Nobuko wasn't expecting that one, I guess. What I thought I might do a little bit today, there's so many things to talk about when you're discussing cognition and cognitive topology and linguistics and everything. I could probably wax, maybe not extraordinaire, but I could wax for a long time on any of those topics, because I do kind of tend to fall in love with the sound of my own voice. I'll pose if you want, just let me know. And so what I thought I would do is maybe begin a little bit by talking about my favorite subject, me. I can talk about that a lot, I guess. Okay, here's my slide. Oops. No, wrong guy. I know the resemblance is very close. I know it's an easy mistake to make. It happens often. But I thought I might talk a little bit about maybe, how I got to get into linguistic anthropology and my life as a child and things like that. I have my mom here. She can help me out. I went to college and graduate school in the 1980s, and it was a fascinating time. to be, I guess, in linguistic anthropology. Before I do that, I should mention just a little bit about what cognition and cognitive anthropology is supposed to be about. This is Howard Gardner back in 1987, the same time I got my degree, so I figured that's an auspicious year. So I had to have some kind of quote from that year. And I'm not quite sure I understand the depth of it, but it sounds very profound. And I think that it does kind of capture something about linguistic and anthropology and cognition, the idea that in many ways it's a new science, but it's something that people have been talking about for a really, really long time and have yet to really kind of address in any kind of formidable fashion. So let me just say a couple things before I start, you know, talking about my life and times about, I get, you know, cognition and cognitive anthropology and what it's supposed to be. And as we see here, it's just the science of the mind, okay? Only that, nothing more, nothing less, okay? So that means it's a very obvious kind of science. But in particular, for cognitive anthropologists, it's to study the connection, the relationship between human society and human thought. And so how do groups conceive of and think about and experience the events of their world? How do they make phenomenological, I guess, explanation of what kind of goes on around about them? So it's cognition in its broadest form and how culture influences that cognition. And there are many aspects of this, and I'm going to talk about two, I guess, today. And hopefully it'll be obvious how they're connected, though maybe it might not be, but it's obvious to me anyway. Two things I want to talk about is culture as cognition. That is, as you see here, the ideos, the rational, the intellectual, the logical side of this, as opposed to the affective or the emotional side of culture. This is Gregory Bateson who came up with these fancy words. You know, it's science, of course. This is why we have these fancy things and, I guess, quote marks like that. We're compelled to always show a picture of Margaret Mead in any talk that an anthropologist gives. That's his second wife right there, his second wife, her third, okay, husband, Margaret Mead and Gregory Bateson. The second thing that I want to talk about today is culture is categorization, culture is classification. That is the interplay, the necessity between making generalizations, okay, when you see something, and you know, looking at differences that don't matter, ignoring them, looking at differences that do matter, and then making categories and distinctions, you know, accordingly. It's one of those things that we often forget about. We think that ignoring things is not so important. My students tell me that ignoring things is important all the time. But it's important for us, I think, also in everyday activities. You know, when you're in a psychology class, when you're getting to that section, you know, in Psych 101 on perception, you're focusing on things like threshold levels and stimuli and things like that. What is it that will make, you know, something respond? Okay, what is it that you'll respond to? What's the threshold level that you need? They oftentimes neglect to tell you that you need to ignore just as much. Because for the most part, when we're walking down the aisle into a lecture hall, for instance, okay, there are a million chairs there. And the mammalian brain, okay, the magic of the mammalian brain, it automatically kind of puts them all together in one great big giant lump. These are auditorium chairs. One is as good as another. They are all the same. Even though in reality they are not, okay? I mean, especially like in my place where I teach in Capon Auditorium, there's all kinds of editorial comments about my lectures written on the back of the chairs. And so I can tell you that every chair is different in Capon. The people in the back rows really don't like me at all. but we kind of put them all together instantaneously without even thinking about it. We ignore the differences that don't make a difference. We don't look at the things that really are not so important, and we know what these might be. Even though, of course, you know, chairs obviously come in many different kinds of flavors and shapes, and sometimes it is important. So, for instance, if I was going to be playing the cello, probably I'd prefer a chair like this without arms as opposed to something like that because I want, you know, some arms to, you know, not in my way. So basically what we are doing is ignoring, okay, many things and paying attention just to the differences that really are important that do make a difference. Now, back in the 70s or 80s, when I was, you know, in graduate school and going to college, the predominant theory of linguistics and probably all of intellectual life at this time was that, I guess, dominated by Noam Chomsky. Now, he's a great guy. I like him a lot and respect him. He was here 4 years ago when I took this picture. He's also known for his politics and things, but he literally revolutionized 20th century linguistics. And basically, Chomsky and most of, intellectual, linguistic, and psychological life at this time in the 80s, when it kind of peaked, was that language is very much an innate property, okay? It's almost like there's an organ for it, just like we have a heart or a liver or a kidney or something. It's almost pre-programmed into us. And the differences between languages, of course, are really slight. Now, of course, anybody who's studying a particular foreign language, learning the outside, the chrome, of course, it's going to be very difficult for them, depending upon the language that you speak. But in essence, they can all be reduced to really kind of one language. They're all kind of the same, of just slight variance among one another. And so they'd be paid to the code, to the formalities, you know, to this aspect. This is where the action is really taking place. Okay, this is the thing that you really need to kind of take a look at. Okay, and this was the dominant model for a very long time in linguistics. Now, there were others, of course, in anthropology who kind of wondered about this. Are languages really all the same? Are these differences that are on the surface level really as trivial as made out by the autonomous linguists? Are there other things we need to take a look at as well? Are the differences as equally important in many ways? Now, to be sure, I think what Chomsky is saying about language in many ways is absolutely right. There is much of language that is certainly pre-wired into us in some ways, the capacity for it, to be sure, okay, in ways that we find other even primates don't really seem to have. So there's no doubt that there's a lot of these universals about language is really important. But I think we sometimes also ignore the differences at our peril. And I became really consciously aware of this, and I apologize to... this is my wife. She's the one on the right. and her pride and joy. Okay, Friday the Wonder Horse. Nobuko, as I think a lot of you may know, is not only a faculty member here, so I can tease her a bit, but she's also a champion rider. And so here she is, you know, going through her paces here. And there she is again. She's still the one on the right, by the way, after she won her trophy for what she was doing in the previous slide. And I noticed, again, talking about me, because it's my favorite subject today, is that as patient and as wonderful as both of us are, okay, with each other, we never fight, we never argue. Okay, sometimes, there are people in the front row laughing and smirking. Who know better, okay? One day I decided to sit back and think about, well, why are we having fights over little things? And it started to dawn on me that really, some of the things we were fighting about were very small, picayune linguistic things that at first glance you might not notice, that you might not pay attention to. So, for example, to put something in a stall, on a stall, by a stall, is very, very important if you're a writer, okay? So it's these little words that are kind of important. Or to insert something in a stirrup, on a stirrup, by a stirrup. Those things are very important. And likewise, okay, English articles, just take one example. What linguists call definiteness is another important thing. And believe me, if you get your articles wrong, okay, it can make some really big differences in trying to communicate with somebody. Now, as we know, okay, all nouns in English can have three things come in front of them. Okay, this is about as linguistic as it'll get. Don't worry. Okay, so either we can say a the like the sun, we can say an a as or an, you know, a cat, an apple, something like that. Or they take nothing, like Jane or Jim. So that's pretty much the party line, okay? Now, the explanation for this goes something like this. Obviously, it's a bit more subtle, but this is what you would probably get like in an ESL book or the kind of man on the street, woman on the street kind of response if anybody would ask you, you know, would ask you, why does something take an article? And the idea is if there's just one thing, you can use the sun. There's only one of them, so it's the sun. If there are many, like there are lots of apples, you use an or an. And if it's a proper name or something like that, you use nothing. New York, Chicago, Jim, ISU, those kinds of things. Now, that's kind of how it's supposed to be, in theory. But they're really, really tricky, and I'm sure probably all of you have realized, okay, it's much more subtle than that. And if you've ever had the privilege, and it really is indeed a privilege, to interact very much with a non-native speaker, you will find out many things, okay? First of all, okay, as we say here, it's something that every child picks up immediately. There's probably no kid in elementary school that makes a mistake with articles in English. Any native-speaking English child will get the articles right. So you master this by the time you're six. And there's, you know, absolutely no mistakes that are usually made with these things. As opposed to certain kinds of other transformations like, you know, subjunctive tense and things like that. It takes a while for the kids to acquire. Articles are acquired really early on, and they're pretty much mistake-free by the time you get to elementary school. On the other side, okay, if you're a non-native speaker of English, okay, no matter how many years you've been here, and how good your English might be, and how good your pronunciation might be, Articleness is something that's really, really hard to ever get 100% correctly. And in fact, it's probably the key. You know, you can always tell if someone's really a native speaker or not. Sometimes you really can't tell because the accent is so clear and so good and the grammar is so clear and so good. When you start paying attention to the articles, and you probably can see, okay, how the articles are being used and that they're really being used 100% correctly. So something's going on with them. And as an example right here, I mean, just ask any kid, I'm going to see the Jane, and see how they respond. They will probably all giggle, know it's funny. Might not be able to explain why, okay, but they know it's kind of humorous because it's a very bad use of articles, and they would be quite amused by it. But definiteness, okay, is something that's really tricky, okay? So, for example, wars have been fought over this. This is a correct interpretation of the Bible. This is the correct interpretation of the Bible. Or something on this order here, to use something maybe a bit more, I guess, down to earth. Okay, I'm going to the toilet, okay, is something probably we would say. But there are many out there. I mean, even on this first floor, there are at least three or four. I don't know why we can't say I'm going to a toilet, but somehow that sounds kind of funny. And likewise, I guess I'm going to toilet probably sounds like I'm going to pot. You know, I'm falling apart. That would never be said at all, I guess. So something's being conveyed in all this, okay. Or to use a less, I guess, colorful example, there's even some differences between, I guess, the Queen's English speakers and over across the pond and here. So he graduated from college last year. He graduated from the college last year. He graduated from a college last year. I mean, it sounds like, well, he got through something, you know. somebody took him, you know, but then he graduated from it, okay. Normally, we'd probably say he graduated from college. But what about university, okay? He graduated from university last year. That sounds a bit more funny than he graduated from college last year. He graduated from a university last year. I'm not quite sure. He graduated from the university last year. Oftentimes, this is the one I think we would hear more commonly said. He graduated from university last year. I graduated from school last year. So now what's kind of going on here? And of course, over in England, they would probably say he graduated university with no problem at all right there. So articles are tricky. So look here. Now, if you have nouns all from the same domain, the same class of things, so in this case, let's say diseases, you would expect them to behave the same way. They should also get the same number of articles, the same kind of articles, in the same way. If they're all the same kind of animal, why not? So I guess the party line is, okay, if you're talking about, you know, definiteness, you see, they probably should all have nothing because they're very specific. So I have cancer, I have tuberculosis, I have Parkinson's, I have heartburn, I don't know why it's shaking like that. Is it me? Is it residuals? My mom told me that they would catch up with me. I didn't believe her, but I guess they did. I have head lice, I have clogged arteries, and so on. But for some articles, we say, I have a cold, a headache, a fever, a cyst, a toothache, a panic attack. And some things we say, I have the flu, I have the measles, I have the chickenpox, the H1N1 virus, the runs, the clap, and so on, as you see there. Just as an example, guys, you know, it's all for science. Okay. So the moral here, something about the world is being conveyed. Something is being conveyed in all this. But what? Okay? And so I would argue that these, you know, saying I have swine flu versus saying I have the N1H1 virus, or pardon me, H1N1 virus, or any variant thereof, that's the piglet variation, I guess. There's something being conveyed in this. Now, what it is, it's very hard to explain. And believe me, I've had people try to, ask me many times to explain why is some article being used this time and why sometimes not. And even though I've been trained in linguistics, I am always hard-pressed. And Nobuko can tell you how frustrating it is for her to ask me something and for me to kind of just scratch my head and say, well, I'm not quite sure. In fact, usually she can kind of give me a better answer than I can myself, even though I'm a native speaker of English. And so articles are tricky, but they're really, really tricky. So even consider something like this, okay? Here we can say something like, she had the measles last year, or she had measles last year. Sounds kind of funny, but in this case, it looks like the or nothing is a free variation. Okay, either the or nothing seems to work. Or to say they're really, really, really tricky, look at this, okay? She had a flu last year. You would think it should be a flu because there's so many. They mutate so often, and so I had one of the variants of the flus out there. I had a flu last year. But we don't say that. We say I had the flu last year, like there's only one. And very few people say I had flu last year. That sounds, again, kind of strange. But we can say I had a flu bug. So somehow that changes everything if we add bug in there somehow. Now, it's not just English, of course, that this happens. I, I mention only this because people probably know English here in this room better than other languages, but I can tell you of some of the interesting interactions Nobuko and I have, okay? One time I said this, and those of you who may know, to set the stage, Nobuko, my wife, thinks I drink too much Coke, which is probably true. I have water tonight, though, okay, see? So I do listen. I am trainable. So one time I said, okay, I couldn't find any Coke, so I said, Nobuko ga koro ononda? And she got really mad and says, no, I hate that stupid stuff. Like, you know that, I would drink it, okay? Because the idea behind the use of wa versus ga is a matter of whether they are indicating subject or indicating topic. That's the party line you get in like a Japanese introductory textbook. You learn this the first week of there. That subjects get marked by ga, Nobuko ga, so Nobuko you, okay? Did you drink the Coke? If you're talking about something, okay, the wa, that just means what the sentence is about. What I should have said was something like this, Nobuko wa koro ononda, okay? Nobuko, as for Nobuko, speaking of Nobuko, speaking of you, okay, was it you who happened to drink the Coke, okay? As opposed to being accusatory like in the first sentence, okay? It sounds like you drank the Coke, you drank my last Coke, why don't I have it? And so when I found later on, and I paid attention to this, okay, if I say Nobuko wa koro ononda, she would say things like this, no, I bought you a new bottle yesterday and I put it downstairs for you, okay, my loving husband. Okay, so these little words are really, really very important, okay, and they make a big, big difference, okay, in ways that we can't always really tell and or that we're always aware of. And so I would think sometimes a lot of our confusions, perhaps maybe even some of our fights, might be due to things like this. Now let me go back to last year. Back in Japan, okay, again, speaking of the 80s again, back when I was, I guess, a hairier self, though I guess not so much on the arms. and speaking of which, of course, there was my old friend, the Japanese version of Coca-Cola bottle sitting right there, so at least I'm consistent. Let me go back and tell you, again, another incident I had in my first trip to Japan that I think maybe kind of, I think, demonstrates some of these things I was talking about before. The first week in Japan, or the first week in Japanese school, you learn two very important words, okay? One is kaberu, to eat. The other is nomu, to drink, okay? So you see here, this is a woman eating and a woman drinking, and a guy drinking too, okay? And for the most part, if you look these things up in a dictionary, English-Japanese dictionary, you will find that kaberu says to eat, nomu says to drink. And so, well, you know, I got those going for me now, so at least I can survive. If I'm abandoned in Japan, I can at least eat and drink. So I thought everything was cool. But you find that there are a few weird things, though. It doesn't always work out this way. So, for example, for things like water and beer, yes, we drink them, and so do the Japanese. They also nomu them, okay? And for hamburgers and sushi and those kind of things, we eat them, and the Japanese taberu them. So far, so good. As the party line expects, we're doing all right. But there are a few aberrancies here. Okay, at the time, I kind of just chalked up to just weirdness, okay? So for chicken soup, that's something that we eat, okay? The Japanese don't taberu them, they nomu them. And, well, how often does chicken soup come up? Okay, it's a weird thing, okay, so what? But what about aspirin, okay, or medicine? Well, we take aspirins. The Japanese don't eat them, they drink them. They drink aspirin, which I thought was kind of interesting. And then you find some weird cases. So, for example, like if Annie the Wonder Dog, our Wonder Dog, gets an aspirin off the floor, okay, if we were speaking English, don't can I say Annie ate the aspirin, Annie's eating the aspirin, okay, just like the Japanese do, okay. We'll come back to this in a second, why this is kind of interesting. So there were a few interesting cases here, but I figured I'm okay. I have survival Japanese. I can get by. I can eat and drink and be merry and do okay if I ever get abandoned in Japan. So one day I went to the Ueno Zoo, which was kind of like the Brookfield Zoo of Tokyo. Very nice and interesting zoo, by the way. And while I was there, of course, as is often the case, I ran across a group of school children going along, you know, on their field trips. And you'll find many of these in any kind of, in any kind of place in Japan. You'll find groups of school children being led by teachers and chaperones, oftentimes with flags, all in their little uniforms and things and something like this here. And I was in the reptile house, and there was a group of school children all right there, okay, looking at the different snakes and lizards and stuff like that. And the zookeeper was giving them the field trip tour and showing them all the different animals and so on, and showed them the big python. And one of the little kids asked, the zookeeper, what does a python nomu? What does a python drink? And I figured, well, heck, I'm as smart as a Japanese fifth grader, because even I know that question. Okay, even mosquitoes and ladybugs, drink water, so it's got to be water, right? What a dumb kid, okay? And I translated it real carefully in my head to make sure that I got it right, okay? But I was surprised and really quite taken aback by the answer. Because the zookeeper said it was a good question, huh? And he answered, okay, Nezumi onomo. Literally, they drink mice or rats. Nezumi means mice, rats, and rodents of all kinds. Now that threw me for a loop. I guess I wasn't as smart as a Japanese fifth grader after all. I'm thinking, this is really kind of interesting. But then, after giving it much thought, it kind of dawned on me. Think about it. What's going on here? Okay. What do pythons do? Now, this was actually in Brazil last year, not this particular one this big, but where we were staying, a python got into like a chicken crate and ate some eggs in one of the chickens. Of course, by that time, it got so big it couldn't sneak out of the cage again. So they and this commune, being very Buddhist, decided not to kill the snake. They just kind of let it sit there until it could kind of, you know, go out again. But as we all know, or should know, even if we're not, Tony, is it heptologists? What are snake people? Okay, they're herpetologists. Okay, even if we're not, sorry, Evan would know. Even if we're not a herpetologist, we all know what goes on with pythons is that they don't chew, they swallow the mouse or the human or whoever whole, okay, and digest it. And of course, like in this guy's case here, he can't go back because he's kind of stuck because he's digesting what he has right here. Just likewise, when we were in Brazil, the chicken that got ate, and the snake had to digest it for a while. The important thing here, there's not chewing. There was no chewing taking place. There was no chewing taking place. Now, that's something you think that anybody should know, and every Japanese person does know, but it's such common sense knowledge, no one ever thinks to tell you this. Okay, I have some of the world's best Japanese teachers. I mean, people who are internationally known, who wrote textbooks. And I guess they might have told me sometime, and I might have been sleeping or something that day, but it was something so inconsequential, I didn't really think to focus on it, because, of course, any person with common sense realizes that when you're eating and drinking, we're talking about chewing or not, chewing or not. So this little table here indicates a number of things that's really kind of interesting, which I did not know myself. Well, first of all, okay, we have the obvious one that when the Japanese are either doing nomu or taberu, they're distinguishing between whether or not something is being chewed or whether something is not being chewed, okay? Which is why chicken soup, okay, for example, is drunk because you're not chewing it, which is why medicine, okay, is not eaten, but it's drunk because you don't really chew an aspirin for the most part, you kind of swallow it whole, okay? But an aspirin on the floor that the dog is chewing is taberu, he's eating it, okay? So they're making a distinction between chewing versus non-chewing. While in the United States, we're making a distinction between liquids versus non-liquids. Okay, we drink liquids. Okay, we eat solid foods or consumables. But another thing here, if you look at this last one, I noticed too that we are also making a distinction, which I didn't pay attention to before. No one told me. Okay, my mom didn't tell me this. Of course, she probably didn't know because native speakers don't need to be explained to these things. Just like probably Nobuko's mom didn't tell her that nomu means, you know, chewing versus non-chewing. Okay, these things that we pick up by tacit knowledge. Okay, we're also making a distinction between consumables versus, you know, versus foods, okay, as we see here. So consumables are foods, of which there are two kinds, liquids versus non-liquids, but they also can contrast, as cognitive anthropologists like to say, with medicines, okay? So this is why we can see what's kind of going on here in this last line with dogs taking or eating aspirins or not, okay? So now the question about all this then means... As any anthropologist will tell you, there are no superior or inferior languages. Every language is simple. Every language is hard. You can say anything in any language. Okay, there is no limit on this at all. Okay, so all languages are equal. All languages are equally difficult. All languages are equally simple. All languages are equally complex. Okay, anything can be said in any language. Anything can be thunk in any language. But that said, okay, there are certain shortcuts or defaults in a language that somehow might make things a bit more convenient or perhaps easier to talk about, okay? And these can be both lexical, that is, with words, or they can be both syntactical, with grammar, okay? So there, even though every language is the same, there are some things, some defaults, there are some parameters out there that perhaps might allow certain things to be said more easily in certain ways. Because languages divide the world, right? Languages divide up things, okay? And so it's possible... And this is, I guess, the question. Can these defaults imply something about the worldview of speakers? In other words, these kind of defaults you carry with you and have inside of you internally that you cannot even explain to others, okay, like me trying to explain the article system to a non-native speaker. Is it possible that these things affect how we perceive and think about the world? And this is called the superior wharf hypothesis, this idea that your language, okay, in a sense, kind of affects how you view reality, how you experience the world around you. I should mention, being that we have a big insurance company, or two big insurance companies, here in this town, that Benjamin Lee Whorf actually was not a linguist. He was kind of an amateur linguist who studied off and on with Edward Sapir, who's probably the greatest Native American linguist of his day. He probably knew more about Native American languages up until the 1940s than probably anybody alive. Anyway, Whorf was a student who actually carried this philosophy to its logical extreme. And he was an insurance investigator, okay, for the Hartford Insurance Companies in Connecticut. And in the 20s and 30s, before cars and gasolines and garages, when he was investigating accidents, he noticed that there were a lot of fires in garages caused by empty gasoline cans. Now, of course, as any fifth grader knows, that empty, okay, does not necessarily mean devoid of gas, because it's the fumes, of course, obviously, in a can that are the most deadly and the most volatile, okay? So he got to thinking that because of people thinking about the world with empty gas cans, perhaps somehow they're experiencing the world in different ways. So if we observe different languages describing the world differently, okay, then perhaps, okay, what we see here is that these differences perhaps maybe are incommensurate. And if we take then the next step, that we find you're speaking a different language, you're seeing the world differently, or paying attention to different aspects of reality differently. Therefore, perhaps it could very well be, maybe it's possible, that linguistic diversity then, okay, could somehow be one way of explaining or predicting at least some aspects of cognitive and cultural diversity. So in other words, to put that in fancy everyday speech, okay, it could be that the language affects how you experience the world, how you think about the world. Now, obviously, in a strong form, okay, it can't be true, because if that was the case, we would not be able to translate from one language to another, and we can do that fairly easily, though certain things obviously are easier to translate than others. So when it's an extreme form, are we living in totally incommensurate worlds? That's obviously false, because as I said, there'd be no way that we could, you know, even somehow can converse at all. But at the same time too, okay, between that extreme and the other, saying that all languages are exactly the same, there may be some wiggle room in the middle there, where we find that speaking different languages make us think about things in perhaps very different ways. Okay, let me give you just a few more examples, and we'll talk about some other things happening in Japan. Again, using Japanese, just because I guess it's the language I know better than some others, but I could use probably other languages as well. Let's talk about verbal adjectives for a minute. And you guys are all thinking, uh-oh, verbal adjectives. This doesn't sound good. It's going to be okay, guys. It'll be all right. Now, imagine, okay, a Japanese speaker and an English speaker is sitting in this nice field right here, looking at this very beautiful blue sky and this wonderful kind of, I guess, green hill. Now, of course, in English, we would say the grass is green, okay? Because most Indo-European languages, of which, you're, you know, English is one, basically, we have the subject, okay, in this case, grass. We have this property, green, okay? And they're married by this magical verb, the copular verb, to be, okay? That marries a property together. So we have a thing and a property. So grass is green. Professor is handsome. So on, like that, okay? And this magical copula, this verb to be here, somehow marries these things together. So it's almost like a coloring book, okay? So you have this blank thing, and then you find the green is kind of being painted on top of that. Now, most of the languages in Asia don't do that. Most of the languages in Asia, okay, these things that we would call properties or adjectives, green, for instance, would be like, they behave like verbs. So what we'd be saying, like in Japanese, is that the grass bees green, or the grass greens. There's no really good way to kind of say this in English. And you can see this when you look at how things decline. So for instance, okay, it's blue, but we'll talk about skies, okay? Blue and green are kind of tricky in Japanese. Let's talk about sky, okay? Aoi is blue, okay? Now, if you want to say that something is not blue, what you do is you conjugate and decline that adjective for negation and for tense, okay? You don't do it with the verb, with the is, or something like that. The actual adjective itself declines for tense. So, aku nakata means was not blue, okay? Just like walk, walking, didn't walk, those kind of things all take place in the verb. In Japanese, they take place in the adjective. So, it greened, it didn't green, it ungreened, those kind of things. So, if you say something like, okay, soraga aku nakata, okay, the sky, okay, kind of verb, maybe in quotes here, okay? These are markers for past and for negation. So the sky was not blue. Literally, you're saying something like, okay, the sky was not blued, it was not bluing, it was not in the process of being blued, it didn't blue, and I guess there's many ways to say that badly, but you kind of get the idea. Okay, so the question then is, are the experiences the same? And of course, then the concomitant question goes along with this. If you're a fluent speaker of two languages, okay, are your experiences the same when you're thinking and speaking, say, in one language, or you're speaking and thinking like in another language? Okay, and these are really, really important questions, but they're very difficult to answer because, as we know, we can't unscrew the cap of the brain and look down there to see what's really kind of going on. So we can only get at these things kind of indirectly. And maybe I'll talk about a few of those in just a few minutes here. Okay. Again, just one last example about little things, about little words. Okay. For example, in English, we make a big distinction between on and above. And you might think it's not really that important, but it's really, really important, let me tell you. From experience, I can tell you. If something is on a desk, it's not the same thing as something being above a desk. But in Japanese and Korean and in Chinese and many, many other languages in Asia, okay, above or on doesn't really matter because as long as it's above the thing, you're okay. But as you probably can guess, there are many ways to go wrong when two people from different languages are speaking these kind of things. If you come from a language where you think above is good enough, and it's the same thing as being on when it's not. Okay, so once more, it's these little things that I think are kind of important. So then in brief, Sapir-Whorf is basically saying that all these differences, okay, things like verbs and prepositions and definiteness and non-definiteness and those kind of things, taken all together, even though by themselves, these little things by themselves might not matter, but if you put them all together, okay, it might make a difference. Okay, people might actually perceive, think about, talk about, experience the world differently if you are having these different kinds of things, these different kinds of defaults. Okay, now let's go back to me in Japan again, my favorite subject. Okay, my first trip to Japan, I noticed something rather curious again, besides just snakes and eating mice and those kind of things. The Japanese have two words for rice. Okay, one is, as you see on the left-hand side here, raisu. Okay, written. Got my thingy here. What did I do with it? Did I lose it? Evan, help me. Here we go. Evan always had these things for me when he was my TA. There we go. Thank you, Evan. Okay. Whoops, wrong direction. Okay. So this is just one way of writing rice in a form I'll talk about in a minute. And then we have the, I guess, more traditional way of saying rice, gohan. Okay. Now, rice is such an important staple crop in Japanese that it can even be synonymous with meals. So gohan dayo is a way of just saying, hey, dinner's ready. You may not even necessarily be having rice that time, but okay, it's so important. Okay. Now, I noticed when I was in Japan that I was hearing a lot of these things, a lot of rice to this and a lot of rice to that being said. And I was thinking, well, this is kind of interesting. Why do we have this English borrowed word rice, okay, when they have a perfectly good term already that's been, you know, satisfying them for at least 2,000 years? What's the boogie here? And at first I thought it was because, well, I'm a weird foreigner, okay? So us weird foreigners in Japan, being that we're there, okay, they're saying rice to for our, you know, for us. They're doing us a favor. So if there's a weird foreigner like me being over there, or they're speaking about some kind of like American dish, okay, or something, then, of course, we're going to change everything from gohan to raisu for our benefit. But then I noticed that, you know, Japanese, of course, speaking to themselves, even when I was out of earshot, okay, when I was kind of, you know, just kind of sulking around and listening surreptitiously, people also would sometimes say it themselves to each other. Well, then I thought, okay, being the, you know, I'm a sociolinguist here, I should be able to figure this out. Maybe it has to do with, okay, the kind of food. Okay, so if it's served on a kind of a foreign dish, so for example, like curry rice curry, or as opposed to it's going to be rice. If it's in a traditional Japanese dish, like kakigori, okay, tori gohan, those kinds of things, so like what do they call that thing in English? Oysters, okay. Then we're going to be using the more traditional term. But that didn't always kind of work either, because we see that sometimes they did, sometimes they didn't. So then I thought, well, it had to do with restaurants, okay? If you're in a traditional Japanese restaurant, shokudo, okay, you're going to be served gohan. If you're in a new, trendy, fancy, chic, Asian fusion kind of restaurant, okay, you're going to be getting rice. That wasn't always the case either, because you could get curry rice, okay, in a shokudo. You'd get these other traditional dishes in a more fancy restaurant. I finally figured it out, so I thought. It had to do with plate, okay? The utensils. If it's going to be served, if the food is going to be served in a chawan, a traditional Japanese rice bowl, of course it's going to be called then gohan. If it's on a plate like this, of course, then it's going to be called rice. And I was surprised, though, when I was in Tohoku, a place not known anyway for its, I guess, modernization. It's kind of the north of Japan. This is from my first book, and the guys were too cheap to actually print my picture, so they had some guy draw it. Okay, this is supposed to be me. I said, if they're going to draw me, give me a lot of hair. Okay, so at least did that. Okay. I saw this billboard in Tohoku, this kind of backwater area of Japan. And you see what it says right here? Nice raisu. Here's a guy, bold guy, okay, in a traditional Japanese clothes, eating nice rice, okay, with chopsticks, in a traditional Japanese, bowl here, chawan. So that kind of blew that theory. And the thing was, okay, the Japanese people thought I was even kind of weird to ask about this. They thought I was really, really strange. So every Japanese for a while that I would think of, that I could run across, I'd ask them, hey, you know, what's the deal with this rice thing? And I'd go through and what's kind of going on about this and that, whatever. And for the most part, they kind of looked at me kind of like, I don't know. Yeah, okay, yeah, I guess you're right. How about them Cubs, you know? Or whatever. I mean, they were very unconcerned about this, and they seemed to be, you know, like just like a non-issue, a non-problem. And that's the case for much of, I think, Japanese borrowing of English. As we see, there's very little paying attention to this as well. Now, to be sure, many loanwords are borrowed from English, as you can see in this table right here. About 94% of them are borrowed. Because I am running out of time here, I'm going to just show a few slides. Take my word for it. There's a lot of English, okay? And most of the borrowing from Japan does come from English. So, as we're going to see in a second, they're English of a certain kind. Now, some are not surprising. So, for example, right here, okay, McDonald's, okay, Makudonaru is how you say it in Japanese. It's written right there in the phonetic alphabet. A word of the world, a modern word, okay, the word McDonald's, okay. I should just in passing say, well, here comes the joke. Okay, here comes the joke. I guess I better get my joke in because, you know, otherwise I'd disappoint everybody. I was standing in line at a McDonald's in Japan, because that's where you have Coke, and there was a little girl with her mom standing in front of me, and of course, you know, looking at me, kind of being the outspoken, weird kind of, you know, person there. The little girl kind of looks up at me and looks up at her mom, and she says, do they have McDonald's in America, too? So, I kid you not, that is absolutely true. Okay. But it shows that it's become so nativized, and it's become so part of the culture, that there's very little at this point we can say about. Other things you find, and these are just some shots that you can find almost everywhere. Summer before last, Nobuko and I were in Japan, and we went to a big summer chance. We were, you know, buying lottery tickets at a mall, buying different things. This is where I lived in Japan when I was doing my dissertation research. It's a little dark, you might not be able to see, but if you look real carefully right there, okay, he's going to see right there, Interstate 55, okay, in front of a shoe store. I wish you could make it just a little bit darker, but it's South 55, by the way, too, okay, so that I had to show people because actually it's my own hometown. Now, the thing about a lot of the Japanese that you'll find, or a lot of the English you find in Japan, is actually English that you might not know about unless you have some facility like in the writing system. This is Dog World, okay, and so for Loretta, this is for you. Okay, this is the Japanese character for dog, okay? And here's the way we're saying it in English, dog world. Okay, it's in Japanese letters, though, but it's basically, this is dog waldo, okay? So there are many, many, I guess, secret ways that these words are being brought into, Japanese, you know, from English, okay, in different ways. I guess we have to talk about Clap Hair Salon. Actually, they do a very good job, by the way, just in passing. And I'll mention this last one here before I kind of talk about some other things real quickly here. You'll see one of the points I'm trying to make here is that the Japanese are taking these English resources and using them for their own devices. Okay, they're using them for their own kind of devices. So, like, for example, right here, we'd probably say, it's demo. Okay. Now, if you said that in English, okay, it's demo, it could be like, it's a demo, it's a demonstration. It really is a store here that's open 24 hours. It's always open anytime. If you look at it, okay, this way, especially with this little apostrophe right there, it's very close to the Japanese word itsudemo, okay, meaning open all the time, okay, all the time, anytime you're ready. And so these are the kind of orthographic puns we see taking place. Let me just go back or go forward and skip to like one fast one I want to show you here real quickly. As you can see, I kind of overestimated how many slides I was going to show by a factor of 10 or so, maybe 100. That's Chicago, by the way. Okay. I guess I will mention them just because they're so cool. The mixtures of the different orthographies together is kind of fun. This is actually how they're written in Japanese, with the Roman letters and then the so-called characters over here. Those characters pronounced you, okay? It's also the character to mean play, okay, in Japanese. So I need you. So this means I need you, I need to play, I need a vacation, I need to kind of get away from it all. These are all from Japanese tourist agency here. Okay, another one they were talking about, like this last one here, okay, island, okay. This was, I couldn't show the whole slide because what you see in this particular advertisement, they're a bit more liberal than the commercials in Japan, of a very topless woman, okay, on a very beautiful beach, okay, talking about her being, you know, laying down in the beach in this island, okay. Now, if you speak Japanese, you probably would catch the pun because this is the way you write in English, land, okay, you see over there. This character is pronounced I, so you're talking about this island that she's on, but this character is the word for love, both of the platonic and the non-platonic kind. And so combined with the picture, you'll see, I think, the connections are pretty obvious. I had to investigate that one really closely for research purposes. Okay, I guess we at least have to talk about, again, speaking of the connections between the word puns and plays. Hikaru Genji, okay, is, you know, the tale of Genji in Japan is probably the world, or it's the Japanese Shakespeare, Chaucer, Melville, both British and American literature all combined into one thing, okay? Genji is a very important figure, and it appears in popular culture. It's also the name of a rock group, Hikaru Genji. But they're writing it in this kind of way here, as you see in this chart, and I apologize for this one not being in color. I'm not the greatest AV person in the world. Trying to do fancy things in the background, I lost the color to the front. But I'd already made the slides by then and burned the CD. So, but even still, I think see what's kind of going on here. So they're writing it in the character for Hikaru, bright, okay, bright Genji, okay, and here's the writing it in kanji. The closest thing might be in English would be something like this, I guess. If you're talking about Hamlet, okay, would be the equivalent, okay, if you have ham, get it, okay, with the lit right over there. Let me just give you one last example here because things are getting out of... There we go. Okay. And I promise this will be the last of the last because we are getting running close to time here. Okay. I have to mention, again, speaking of my own favorite product, okay, is the I Feel Coke advertisements in Japan that have been going on since the 70s, 80s, since when I've been there, through the 90s, and I think they're still there. Variations on this thing right here, Sawayaka Tasty I Feel Coke. So it's part written in Japanese, part written in English. Okay. Now, Sawayaka kind of means... refreshing. It has the implication of something bubbly. I mean, you probably couldn't say Sawayaka Tasty I Feel Lemonade. I don't think that would quite work the same way. It didn't have the same kind of feeling. Here we have the English word tasty written in Japanese, and here we have the English I Feel Coke. I feel Coke. I feel like a Coke. I feel like I'm in this Coke world. It's tasty. It's also kind of bubbly and delicious. It's also very relaxing and refreshing. And what I would argue here is that what's happening, okay, to kind of tie them back to the stuff we were talking about in the beginning of the discussion, that what we're seeing here are the creations of new categories, okay? That this, as I said before, Sawayaka Tasty would not work for just any drink, okay? This idea of Sawayaka Tasty being a noun that would, you know, modify a certain kind of product, a certain kind of thing, a certain kind of animal or drink, okay, is something that's, I think, being really developed now in Japanese. And they would be hard-pressed, I think, to think about them, to create them, without the resources of English, okay? So just like Chinese 1,000 years ago, okay, was brought into to Japanese and used for Japanese purposes, leaving a legacy now of a rather interesting, complex writing system. Likewise, I think we're seeing today English being brought into Japanese and being used in very creative and very idiosyncratic and very, I think, rather interesting kinds of ways. Now, I think I'm going to stop there because I was told to leave a few minutes for questions. I have many slides I can show you if you still want to go back, but only if by request. And I told my joke, so I guess we got everything done. So I will now open it up to any discussions, questions, complaints, and things like that. I, again, want to thank everybody, the committee, the college, my family, friends, colleagues, my chair, dean, everybody for inviting me for this wonderful talk. Thank you so much for giving me this opportunity. So. Right here.
You also have some experience in Indonesia.
Yeah.
Does Indonesian use English in a similar way?
No. Obviously, English is borrowed by every language, and of course, English borrows from every language as well. There are certain neat things that have been done in Indonesia, but nothing like you see here, okay? Depends on how you count. We're talking probably at minimum maybe 4 to 5% of everyday Japanese vocabulary comes from English, just everyday vocabulary. In a Japanese newspaper, some of those statistics, I can show you a slide, show that they're about 10 or 12%. Literally, Japanese could not be spoken today without English. There is so much a part of the whole thinking Japanese. I should mention, too, when I use the word loanword, that's a bit of a misnomer because they are not really borrowed. Most of these English words are made in Japan for Japanese purposes, okay? And majority of them are not transparent to native speakers of English. I happen to choose some here because I thought I'd make a better talk, but many of them are things that you could not really find very easily. So, for example, a virgin road. What might be a virgin road? Of course, they say it in the Japanese for, you know, virgin, but what might be a virgin road? Well, it might be a wishful thinking, but we're talking about the aisle the bride walks down when she's getting married, okay? That's the virgin road. Or romance gray. This is not quite so popular as now, but it was a kind of a word that was popular, say, back in the 80s, romance gray. It's something, unfortunately, I don't have, but maybe Nick could maybe be, well, maybe not even Nick. Not that she's not romantic. You're going to see why I didn't want to pick you. Is anybody proud of their silver hair? They're Richard Gere kind of hair. Okay, Rick. Okay, we'll pick Rick. Okay, he might be romance gray. A kind of a good-looking guy, still kind of sexy and virile, but he's got some gray like in the temples, and so he's romance gray. Okay, just a little. Okay, so these are the kind of loan words that are loan words, so-called, that we find being made in Japan for Japanese purposes. Thank you, and they don't really care. If native speakers of English don't always know what they're talking about. You don't find that like in other places, like in Indonesia, where we don't see this creativity, this originality being taken place. Those that are grammatically challenged go into linguistics, okay? Just like those who are worried about their heart go into cardiology. I'm sorry, there's another hand up over here. Lou?
Jim, could you comment
some slides?
On the fact that those three different things, sawayaka, mm-hmm. tasty, and I feel are written in three different orthographies.
Yes, that's a good point. And again, we could talk about orthography and rebuses and all kinds of things forever. I have slides. What Lou's talking about here is that this right here is written in hiragana, this is written in katakana, this, of course, is written in Roman letters, okay, or this might even be pure English. Now, hiragana and katakana are ways of depicting Japanese in everyday phonetic speech. As I think everybody knows, Chinese characters were borrowed from Japan about 1,500 years or so ago, right? Everybody knows that. Okay. Well, it's true. Okay, about 1,500 years ago, the Chinese came and the Japanese went and borrowed these wonderful characters that the Chinese used to write. Now, no two languages could be so different than Chinese and Japanese. Probably Chinese is closer to English than Japanese is closer to Chinese. So the problem was, how can we make a language like Chinese, which is tonal, which is, you know, pretty much unagglutinative, that's just a fancy linguistic talk for saying, you ain't got a lot of stuff stuck together, okay? Like you do in Japanese, where it's, you know, things get pounded together, okay? You know, tabe sase darimashita, I was not made to eat, okay? That's like one big giant word in Japanese, okay? You can't really say that like in Chinese the same way. You can obviously talk about that idea, but you can't say it that with that kind of glue. So how are you going to come up with a character, even if you're writing English, how are you going to come up with a character for it if you're going to use Chinese writing system to depict your language? What character are you going to do? Well, to depict all the things that they had that the Chinese didn't, they came up with these different kinds of scripts, okay? A kind of one that's used for adverbs and everyday words, or one that's kind of like an italics, okay? So now, and Lou's asking, in many ways, a very important question here. So when you're seeing this as a Japanese speaker, how does this hit you? Okay, so you're seeing your native Japanese orthography, not the character, there's a character that goes for this, but you're seeing this. Now you're seeing this thing, tasty, an English word written in italics, and then you're seeing this I feel Coke, which should, you know, is not really English because I don't know many people in America that talk about I feel Coke. I feel like a Coke, okay, I feel like having Coke, but I really don't feel Coke very often. So now, how is the Japanese experiencing that? I would argue, okay, that there's certain kinds of effective categories that are being made, okay, on the basis of not only just the actual oralness of it, but actually also on the kind of ways depicted in the orthography. okay? The native Japanese word, the borrowed term, and then really in English, okay? And we could talk like 3 hours on this, and that. But you're right, I think the script's really, really important. And in fact, I guess that's what this talk was going to be about, but I ran out of a few slides. Yeah.
Quick question. When we look at the different populations of Japanese around the world,
uh-huh.
Brazil and the U.S. and Canada, everywhere else, do they acquire these same borrowed words?
Uh-huh.
Do they mean the same in these different populations?
It's a very good question. It's an excellent question. So like there's a very large Japanese Brazilian population, about 1.5 million. People of Japanese ancestry living in Brazil now. And as you might expect, the differences between these two languages can be really interesting. So when Japanese Brazilians go back to Japan, I shouldn't say back, but when they go to Japan, even though they may be speaking Japanese and have learned Japanese in Brazil, their Japanese is a little bit different. For one thing, they have some Portuguese loanwords. Secondly, okay, they don't have the same kind of English loanwords in the same way that the Japanese in Japan do. Now, many, of course, are the same. So things like radio, tobacco, cigarettes, taxis, telephone, all those kind of things are going to be the same in both places. But there are some differences because, you know, unless you're in an international Japanese, pan-Japanese diasporic community where you can share this language, okay, things are going to develop in kind of localized areas. And so to be sure, as Nobuko can tell you much better than me, sometimes Japanese people, overseas Japanese, so-called Nikkei, when they go to Japan, the land of their ancestors, don't fit in necessarily as well as everybody might expect, even though they speak the same, you know, the same language. Yeah, Tom.
Are we seeing a cultural backlash of the increasing movement of English into Japan and places that you got nativist belief systems getting further and further entrenched as globalization?
It's an excellent question, and for the longest time, you would see both scholars from America and also scholars from Japan lamenting the pollution of the Japanese language. And for a while, it was thought this was a post-World War II phenomenon. It was the GIs and the occupation and MacArthur and everybody else that went in and, you know, basically, you know, brought all these terrible loanwords into the country. No, Japanese have been borrowing from English for 150 years, thank you. Some of the most entrenched words, okay, were borrowed even before the war. So, for instance, recordo, a record, you know, back when records were records, before they were CDs. Okay, during the war, of course, you know, the military government said, well, we got to get rid of this loan word, okay, and we're going to replace it with omban, euphonic board, okay. Now, of course, people still referred to them as records, and after the war, of course, people kind of threw out the stupid euphonic board kind of, you know, character and used the word that was always being spoken all the time, basically record. Occasionally, every few years, the Japanese Ministry of Education or some other ministry in Japan writes a white paper lamenting the use of English. And it's really funny that you find that in these white papers especially, about 25% of the vocabulary is English, which is kind of ironic. So on one hand, there is this, at least for some people, thinking, yes, there is some pollution of the language. But I would argue that it's not polluting at all, but instead, because it's English that most English speakers couldn't understand, it's made by Japanese for Japanese purposes. It's another linguistic resource that's available for them to use for their own devices. Thank you. And doesn't really matter whether we say that, you know, back in, you know, England or Canada or America or not. Because it's so Japanese now, the vast majority of people probably think it's a tool that we like and it's really cool and we like it. Why not? You know. And so, even though there are scholars and certain purists, as you said, you know, do lament the fact that there's so much English in Japanese, it would be like us today lamenting, you know, there's too much damn French in English, you know?
Amen.
Yeah. any word that ends in T-I-O-N, okay, is a French word and should be, you know, expelled. That, you know, it can't be happening. Yeah. Roger.
Well, I wonder if some of these made in Japan English words, wasei,
uh-huh.
I wonder if some of them don't end up being a liability in the international usage of English. I recall going to the Nagoya Expo and at the entrance they said, please dispose your pet bottles.
Uh-huh, right.
In English.
Was right.
Saying, please dispose your pet bottles. And I saw all of the foreigners going in there shaking their heads. Pet bottle?
What's a pet bottle, right?
Pet
yeah.
Bottle.
Mm-hmm. Here's a pet bottle, by the way, just in passing. Okay.
Right. Every foreigner would understand that. And I wonder if while this is a great linguistic resource for the Japanese, mm-hmm. of course, to do all of this creative borrowing. Doesn't it create the possibility of a liability or misunderstanding?
It's a liability in two ways, and I think it's a good point. The first liability, obviously, is that, as any ESL teacher will tell you, it's in Japan, one of their biggest complaints is they have to get the Japanese students to unlearn so much English, because they think they know so much English already, but these are words that are used for very idiosyncratic, very defined Japanese purposes. So even though you may think you know some English already, okay, it doesn't necessarily get used in the same way as it does, say, in everyday English. So Japanese students studying English, in some sense, you know, have a problem, because it's kind of like an American, or, you know, learning. They're so close. That they kind of interfere with each other, you know. So likewise, here you see these Japanese students sometimes get messed up because they're thinking in Japanese when they're seeing this word, when it's really, you need to think like in an English way, because it may be different. They also, as a liability in the other way, as you said, because many times, for example, like in what you're talking about, there may not be an awareness from the Japanese side that outsiders know that, you know, what the Japanese are thinking about, even though they're using English words. And so that can be a detriment in many ways. So I guess, though, the word of the wise is, if you go to Japan, even though you may speak 10% of your, you know, Japanese already, okay, not quite the same thing. So be really, really careful. You know, go tread lightly. So, yeah, it has potential, I think, for problems and liabilities in many ways as well.
What would Sapir Dwarf say about text messaging and Twitter, and are we getting dumber, and are we getting dumber in different ways in the United States than they might be in Japan?
Okay, those who didn't hear in the back, he says, what would Sapir Dwarf say about twixting and twittering and text messaging, you know, comparing Americans and Japanese? The Japanese, I think, in terms of twittering and text messaging, far surpass the United States in terms of all kinds of neat things and what they're doing. So, for example, on Japanese text messaging, you will see not only, okay, will you find like Roman letters, but you're going to find Slavic letters and, you know, Arabic letters and all kinds of things, and emoticons and a million kind of